Aloha, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Welcome to The Body Show. Each week we talk about health and fitness, but none of what we discuss replaces a visit to your own primary care provider. Happy Heart Month! All February we're going to be talking about heart disease, as it is the month of Valentine's Day. And after talking about the Ornish diet last week to reverse heart disease, today we're going to talk about some new exciting technological advances in the world of cardiology, but we're also going to talk about, are you too young to have heart disease? How young is too young? And for those who are not aware, sometimes even children can be born with developmental problems and grow up to be adults. And what does that mean for their risk for having heart problems? And is there anything they can do about it? Well, in conjunction with our discussion today, we also are going to talk about an exciting conference that is going on this weekend that is absolutely free to the public, and what a great way to spend your day before Valentine's Day. But we're going to be talking about not just cardiac issues in kids, but also in adults, and we're going to hear about some new special technologies that are out there and right here in the islands. So joining me first is Dr. Laura Lyra-Pique. She is a cardiologist at Straub Clinic and Hospital, and she is spearheading the program coming on this Saturday. She's one of the co-chairs, but she's got expertise in all things cardiac, and we're going to talk today about how to know if you have heart disease, what are the signs or symptoms, and what should you do about it, and if you do have it, how serious do you have to be about cholesterol and those sorts of things. And as always, you are part of our conversation as well. So if you've ever been diagnosed with heart disease, or if you have questions about whether or not you would be at risk, even if you don't fit the classic profile, and even what is that profile, you can join us at 941-3689, toll-free Neighbor Islands, 1-877-941-3689. Dr. Apike, welcome to The Body Show.
Thank you. Always glad to spend time with you, Kathy.
Well, and you've been on before, and we've talked about this conference, and, you know, you have some expertise that a lot of folks don't have. Not only do you see people who have heart problems like people I refer to you, but you also see adults who, as children, were followed for what is considered congenital heart problems. And these are problems that, you know, usually you get diagnosed when you're young, or when you're born, or when you're a young child. And very often, you continue to see a cardiologist who has expertise in that problem. But then once you're no longer a kid and you can't fit in the little kid chairs anymore, it's time to see an adult doctor, and I don't know what to do for you, so we send them to you. Tell me a little bit, how young is too young to have heart problems?
Well, there's no age that's too young.
Birth,
okay. Essentially, yes. The most common kind of congenital birth defect is a heart defect. Now, those defects can be simple from the you hear about people who had a hole in the heart, or you can have some really strange ways your arteries are connected to your heart, they're all switched around, or maybe one of your chambers didn't develop. And it's amazing to me that these babies even survive past being born. And one of the reasons it's been very interesting as an adult cardiologist to see these things is, we didn't see this. I didn't see this really in my training. People mentioned it. We might have seen one or two patients. But honestly, most of these babies didn't survive. But throughout the past, you know, maybe 30 years, the procedures and the surgeries, the interventions that they do, people are now surviving. And it is expected that 85% of babies born with a heart defect will survive to age 18.
And so once they get to 18, they look to people like you.
They do. And this has been another problem in their care is, you know, by the time they get to 18, if they're feeling pretty good and they're no longer seeing the pediatric cardiologist, they kind of don't want to go to the doctor anymore. And so there's that problem on the one side. The other side is most adult cardiologists really don't know anything about congenital heart disease.
All right, I feel better because I'm an adult internist and I don't know anything about congenital heart disease. So I feel better. So if cardiologists don't know, I feel better already. So they don't really know how to manage it.
Not
at all. Is it that much different?
Oh, I mean, it is different.
Okay, how is it different?
Well, for one thing, as an adult cardiologist, like, I did not want to take this on. When I was asked, do you want to do this? I said no. Because I just didn't feel I had the knowledge background. And, you know, doctors, we spend a lot of time in training and learning things. And so we have a certain level of confidence when a patient walks in the door. We might not know everything, but we know how to get that information. And we have a pretty good baseline on, you know, how to deal with this person. With a kid with congenital heart disease or an adult with congenital heart disease, most of us feel like we don't know anything. Because we don't even know, what the names of, you had a what, a mustard? Is that like something you eat or something that somebody did to you?
Did you put it on a pretzel? What?
Okay. Right. So, you know, there's a lot that goes into that. And the other thing that happens in adult, when you treat adults, you usually, at least the way our medical system works, you usually don't go looking for trouble, shall we say. You don't test a lot of asymptomatic patients. So if somebody comes to you and says, yeah, I had heart surgery when I was a kid, you say, how are you feeling now? Oh, I feel fine. You know, I work and I do a little bit of exercise. And you say, okay, great. And you kind of say, phew, you know, I guess you're okay. I don't really have to know that much about you. But what we know with these people with congenital defects is they need a lot more screening. You need to be more vigilant about what's going on with them, even if they're not having symptoms, because maybe their hearts are getting weaker, their valves are leaking more. You know, they've been dealing it with this disease since they were a kid, so their bodies are compensating. And they don't have symptoms, but there could be something bad going on.
Well, you know, I got to say, within the last year or so, I was kind of blown away. I had this particular individual, this nice man in his 60s that I was seeing for years, and I kept saying, you know, you got this weird low oxygen level. I don't know why. What's that about? And he goes, oh, yeah, I've always had that. And I said, you know, I don't know. I think we ought to look into this. So, you know, we sent him to see the lung doctor. I figured low oxygen, he's got a lung problem. So he sees the lung doctor, who says, no, he doesn't have any lung problem. Let's go send him for a heart test. And I'm like, yeah, that's probably a good idea. But, you know, most low oxygen is a lung situation. So I don't think we'll see much. But, okay, we could do this test. And next thing that you know, he's got this congenital heart problem that he's had since he was born.
Right.
And, I mean, he was surviving, he was thriving, he was doing fantastic, but I had no idea that this was the cause of his problem. And I think you were the one who said, yeah, he's got this problem. And by the way, he's probably had this for a long time, and he's doing great. He doesn't have any symptoms, but we've got to watch him, make sure that his heart is not weaker. Make sure that he doesn't have a problem with, you know, his other metabolic issues. We always think cholesterol for the heart, and we think those sorts of things. But, you know, we never really worry so much about that unless, like you said, somebody has symptoms and his cholesterol is good. But the only telltale sign was that he had a slightly low oxygen level.
Right.
And he's an adult that was born with a heart problem, never had surgery, and has lived 60-some years. And he's doing fabulous.
Right. And that does happen. We have some patients who are not diagnosed until they're in their 60s. And
it's pretty rare. I would think.
It's fairly rare. One of the other problems we have with treating these kinds of patients is there's not a lot of data to know the, quote, natural history. You know, what will happen to you if we don't do anything? What sort of treatment, if we do an intervention, how will it improve your lifespan or whatever? So they are collecting more and more data now, and those are the guidelines that we go on. But, you know, one of the things is to be honest with your patient and say, there aren't that many patients like you. This is what we know. This is what we hope to know. These are the things that we're looking out for, just to be very honest. And when we say there aren't that many patients like you, there are actually 1 million people, adults, with congenital heart disease that are surviving. So, I mean, that's a lot as a single number goes. So, you know, as a proportion of the population, it's not that many. But, you know, we just don't have enough information. But there's a whole new specialty of cardiology in adult congenital heart disease. That's how important it is.
Because we're realizing that there's more and more people who actually have this. And little did we know, you know, this is something where they're living longer and
right.
And who would have known that they would have done so well? But yay that the field of cardiology has been able to figure out how to do these surgeries when they're babies, that they actually
right.
can live this long.
And let me just tell you, I would not be doing this and would not know half as much as I know now were I not working with a pediatric cardiologist. And that's one of the big benefits that I think we have in our adult congenital heart disease clinic is you get the adult cardiologist and the pediatric cardiologist. Because, I mean, he sees these kids when they're
all
babies.
The time. Right.
And so, you know, we kind of help them transition, and he gives me a lot of insight as to, you know, what happened, what is this disease, and, you know, what were the procedures that were done, and then together, you know, what do we do moving forward?
Well, and that's just another way for people to realize that, you know, although training is over at a certain point, when they say, quote, practicing medicine, it's because you are always learning from every individual. And, you know, the more that you do it, the more that you coordinate with your pediatric colleague, you get to learn even more than you ever right. did. You're still kind of in training in a way.
Right.
You're continuing to learn and have more expertise in an area that not a lot of other people may have had exposure to. And so it's becoming your niche.
It kind of is. I think most of the fear has been replaced by sort of this excitement about, you know, learning more and being able to offer help to patients because, you know, this is not a criticism. I was in that group too. The adult cardiologists really don't know what to do for them or they don't see it enough to feel really comfortable and the data's just not out there. But, you know, being able to try and offer them some help, you know, I like that.
Well, and it makes me feel good because when you say heart doctors don't know something about the heart, I mean, just this particular area, then I feel less guilty as an internal medicine doctor not knowing a whole lot about congenital heart problems because it really can affect you lifelong. But if you have a really good team, you don't have to worry. And so there's a lot of – now, are there technological advances that we're seeing? Are we changing what we do for them? Are there new procedures? Should they be diagnosed when they're older that can still be done?
There are. The most common congenital heart defect that's, you know, serious enough to need treatment when you're young is what they call a tetralogy of Fallot, which are, there are four defects. And one of the repairs is actually closing a hole in the heart and opening up one of the heart valves, the pulmonary valve, which is narrowed. And over time, that pulmonary valve can re-narrow or the artery around it. And it can do that without having any symptoms, and as a secondary effect, the right side of the heart can get very weak. Usually, you can treat that by replacing the pulmonary valve, which traditionally has been done with surgery, but it can be done now through a catheter. And then, yeah, what else do we do for them? Some of them need defibrillators. You know, looking forward to transplant is certainly one thing that we do. But some of the surgeries, again, that were not available in the past can be done now.
Well, and let's talk about that because you mentioned heart valve replacement and repair through a catheter. And we have Dr. Jane Liu here today. And she is an interventional cardiologist at Straub Clinic and Hospital who hails from Pennsylvania, my home state. So happy to have you here today, Dr. Liu. And you've also trained and have expertise in doing this sort of transcatheter valvular repair and replacement. Tell me, what is that all about? I mean, I remember when I was in training and the only people who put in catheters in arteries were to like inject dye in the heart and hopefully open up stents and blockages and things. And we still do that. But now we're getting even fancier. Welcome to the show and tell me what that term is that or what is it that we call that and how has that advanced?
Hey, Kathy. Sorry I'm late. So
nope, you're perfectly on time.
So you're right. Back in the day, what interventional cardiologists did was open up your coronary arteries. And that's what we still do.
Sure.
It's one of the easier things that we do. But, you know, structural heart disease has been a niche that has kind of just taken off in the last couple of years. We now have, prior to the advent of transcatheter aortic valve replacement, if you had a blockage, a severe blockage in your aortic valve, the only treatment for that was surgery. And if you were too sick for surgery or too frail for surgery, or that's how you died. You actually died from this blockage in your aortic valve called aortic stenosis.
What would cause the blockage? Is it just because, you know, you've had a lot of birthdays, which is a nice way to say you've gotten older? Or is there some sort of infection as a kid? Was this like from rheumatic fever? What would make these people get these blockages?
Absolutely. So rheumatic fever, the infection as a child, can absolutely cause valvular heart disease. But the type of blockage we're talking about is the degenerative type, which is the many birthday type. So I always like to
tell
them.
That's such a nice way to put it, right? The many birthday type.
Yeah.
You've had so many candles that the fire department is called when it's your birthday. But all right, gotcha.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I like to tell my patients, you know, I'm not calling you old, but this is what happens when you get old. The valve just starts to degenerate. And the good news is, we now have an option for patients who are too sick for open heart surgery. and they're not ready to die yet. So we have many options. We now have a both balloons and valves that are essentially crimped onto little tiny catheters or little tubes that we can insert through the leg all the way up into the heart. We then use these tubes and balloons and we put them across the blocked valve. We blow up the balloon and it stretches open the valve. The other thing we have is we have a stent that is basically shriveled up onto these little tubes. We bring the stents, which is essentially a new aortic valve, up across the heart, and we deploy the valve, and it is a new functioning valve, a new heart valve made out of cowls made in California. And it's
you're very specific as to where the cows have come from. So, like, if we were to actually describe it, I mean, sometimes people have a hard time visualizing it. But if you have an umbrella that's closed and then you open up an umbrella, it's a lot bigger. And you could picture how that umbrella might fit in your purse. But boy, you can't fit an open umbrella in your purse. So if you just don't open it up until you get outside, you know, you'll be protected from the rain. So is it something similar where it's kind of all scrunched up in a tiny little catheter? And then when it gets to the heart, you open it up?
Absolutely. That's a wonderful analogy, and I wish I had thought about that myself. But yes, you nailed it. That's exactly what the valve and the balloons look like. And that's how we're able to do so many things inside the heart without open heart surgery or leg surgery, you know, any sort of invasive procedures.
Now, previously, people would have to have a big surgery to go ahead and repair or replace their valve. And now we're able to do it in a smaller fashion. Could they choose to do that even if they're not super sick and they could undergo open heart surgery? Could they choose to have this valvular heart replacement done instead? Is that okay?
That is a great question. And your question was essentially what the FDA just designed. So as of right now, as of February 8th, 2016, the answer is no. Unless you are participating in a research trial, you cannot get the minimally invasive valve without being too sick for valve surgery. Because, you know, the FDA here will say, well, Dr. Liu, you know, we know that the surgical valves last such and such amount of years. How do we know your valve is going to last such and such years? And the truth is we don't know because the technology is so new. But truthfully, these valves look amazing. And, you know, you see these patients 1 year, 3 years out, 5 years out from their surgery, and they look amazing. So the FDA actually just approved a study in which if you wanted to participate in a research trial, they are currently enrolling patients who are, quote, not too sick for open heart surgery. Now, if this trial shows promise, which a lot of physicians believe that it will, and if it shows that this minimally invasive technology is not inferior to open heart surgery, this is going to change medicine. I mean, it's the single one thing that's really going to change our field, and it's so exciting.
Absolutely, because, I mean, I'll be honest, I really never want to have heart surgery of any type. But if I have to have heart surgery, I don't want to have open heart surgery. I'd like the minimally invasive stuff. And, you know, that's just, even though I'm young enough to be able to tolerate a procedure should I need one, I wouldn't necessarily volunteer to do that. I'd love to do something minimally invasive if I had to. So I can see where even if you weren't in a situation where you're just too old to be able to recover from a big procedure, you would kind of choose that anyway if you could. So I'm happy the FDA is taking a look at that and starting a trial, because a lot of folks, just regular average everyday working folks, would say, you know, I don't want to be out for 2 or 3 months recovering from a surgery. I want to be out for, you know what, 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, when I did this procedure during training, we did hundreds of these procedures. We got to the point where we were actually sending patients home the very next day after essentially a brand new aortic valve replacement that was minimally invasive. And what's more exciting is my mentor is actually pushing the envelope and he's trying to send them home the same day. So it's all very exciting. But that gives you a sense of just how minimally invasive it is.
and how dramatic it can be for recovery. All right, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Dr. Lorelei Rapike and Dr. Jane Liu. And when we come back, we're going to talk some more about some of the new technological advances in the world of cardiology. We'll talk about different types of stents because there's more than just one and what that means and how do you know if you have a heart problem. When we come back, we will talk some more about it. But if you want to talk with us as well, you can at 941-3689. Toll-free Neighbor Islands 877-941-3689. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
On The Next Humankind.
You think that this is your calling and your career, and then you get into it, and it's much different than it appears. It's much more emotionally draining and physically hard.
The challenges for nurses trying to navigate today's stressed-out healthcare environment. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for Humankind.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
New Letters on the Air celebrates Black History Month with The Symphony, a poetry collective of four African American men who met at Cave Canem and bonded over the work of the late poet Etheridge Knight.
He made me recognize that poetry, in a way, was a chronicling of history.
Dwayne Betts with Randall Horton, Marcus Jackson, and John Murillo on how poetry transforms lives on New Letters on the Air.
Tuesday evening at 6:30. Support for The Body Show comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributor Oceanside Hawaii Assisted Living and Memory Care.
Welcome back to The Body Show. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Dr. Lorelei Rapike, cardiologist at Straub Heart Center, and Dr. Jane Liu, interventional cardiologist at Straub Heart Center as well, and also somebody who knows about the expertise regarding these transcatheter aortic valvular replacements, which you've done plenty of in training, and I know you're hoping to be able to do some more of those here in Hawaii because you have this unique expertise, and we want to take advantage of that. Now, we're talking today about heart disease. Because February is the month of Valentine's Day, and so we like to talk about how we can keep everybody's heart healthy. And if you've ever had a problem with an aortic valve, or if you've had this minimally invasive heart procedure, boy, we'd love to hear about your experience. You can give us a holler at 941-3689, toll-free Neighbor Islands 877-941-3689. Now, we're going to talk in a bit, Dr. Rapike, about the program that you're co-chairing, Valentine in Paradise. It's pretty much cardiovascular health from head to toe, and you're going to have some great speakers there. We'll talk a little bit more about some of their areas of expertise. But one of the things that people always want to know about is, you know, if somebody is concerned that they may be developing heart problems, and they're young, and there are maybe, you know, women or men in their 20s or 30s, although it's unlikely, it's not unheard of.
Right.
When should people do something basic like check their cholesterol, check their blood pressure, all that kind of good stuff?
Well, you should be checking your blood pressure, I think, already when you're in your 20s. And what's interesting, my pediatric cardiologist colleague came to me and said, they're recommending that we start children as low as young as 8 on statins if they have very high cholesterol.
As
yes.
Eight.
And I mean, it's not a really strong recommendation at this point, but it's one of the things to think about because cholesterol levels that are high when you're a child are a big risk factor for developing heart disease when you're older. He also tells me about some of his, you know, 13-year-old patients that weigh nearly 300 pounds. And it's really hard to try and get them to, you know, make changes because it's not just them, it's the whole family. So it's never too early to start looking at your risk factors.
So check your cholesterol. I think the CDC, if I remember correctly, or me, I think it was the CDC, a couple of years ago said anybody over the age of 18, you know, and they might have said younger because mm-hmm. I focus on an adult population.
Right.
So I'm sure there's different rules in the world of pediatrics. But 18 and over, check your cholesterol at least once, fasting profile, do a blood sugar, go ahead and check a blood pressure. Screen for these metabolic issues because you're going to be in a greater position to be able to fix them when you're younger than if you wait until you've had your heart attack, your stroke, et cetera.
Right.
Because by then you're doing not primary prevention, you're doing like cleanup, catch up, we've
right.
got to get back to getting healthy again. So that was one of the recommendations that they made was really check these things early. This
right.
could be really important for you. Because, you know, you can find cholesterol that's pretty scary high in teenagers.
And right.
if they could make some dietary changes or if the whole family could do that, that would help everybody.
Right. And it's not necessarily that you need to start on medication right away. But you should, I mean, all the studies that were done that show benefit of medications, they were all done, supposedly, in conjunction with diet, exercise, you know, weight loss, all those types of things. And that still really is the primary recommendation that we have for addressing these risk factors.
All right. We've got a caller on the line. We have Reggie on the line from Diamond Head. Reggie, welcome to The Body Show.
Hi there. I was just calling to share my experience. I always had a heart murmur since I was a little kid. And then back in June, after a pretty strenuous workout, I'm a circus artist, so I was like up in the air doing my thing up there and had this really like deep pain where it got me kind of nauseous. And long story short, I had to get it checked, and it turned out the mitral valve pretty much blew out, and I had a posterior leaflet flail, and had to go all the way to Georgia to get it repaired. Luckily, they used a Da Vinci robot, so they were able to go in without cracking open my chest and did a full repair. But anyway, I was wondering if by chance some of that technology or expertise would be able to get to Hawaii for other people so that they wouldn't have to fly over to Georgia like I did.
Well, it's a great question. And first off, congratulations for having the coolest job I've ever heard of, circus artist. But in addition, for noticing the symptoms, you know, you had chest pain, you had nausea. Some people might have blown it off and they might not have taken it seriously. And you knew better and you got it checked out. And that's excellent. And I'm glad you made sure that you took care of your body because you felt something different. You know, you mentioned a couple of curious points. The first one was a posterior leaflet flail, a quote, mitral valve blowout. It sounds so dramatic. Dr. Lou, does this happen? Do you blow out your heart valves? And if so, I mean, imagine, would Reggie have had to have a problem with his mitral valve in it, like before this ever happened?
Absolutely. Your story is so wonderful, Reggie. I'm really glad you sound like
happy
you've recovered.
Happy and healthy.
Yes, absolutely.
Just in September that the operation was done, so I'm feeling pretty good.
Wonderful.
Fantastic.
Yeah. This sounds like, truthfully, it actually sounds like you probably had maybe some congenital thing, because you sound also
sure,
young.
He had this heart murmur his whole life, he said, yeah.
Right, and I don't think it was any activity that you did, even though you're a circus acrobat and you must do amazing things, that actually, quote, blew out your mitral valve. I find that would be very rare and unusual, but more or less, I think it may have just been the severity of the leakiness just over time got to the point where it was going to start causing
anymore,
you symptoms. Yeah. You know, as of right now, you know, structural cardiology is a very new and exciting field, and most of the procedures revolve around the aortic valve because that's more people have aortic valve.
The aortic valve is certainly let's talk about the structure of the heart just briefly. So you got these four big chambers. You got the right side, you got the left side. The right side, you have the top and the bottom. The left, you have the top and the bottom. And, you know, just kind of like you would have doors in your house, you have doors between one top part and one bottom part. And so the mitral valve is the one that you're looking at on the left side. It's between the top chamber and the bottom chamber. That's that area where you've got your mitral valve. And the aortic valve is between the bottom chamber and the exit. So a lot of times we see troubles with that bottom chamber and the exit, because if you can't pump blood out of the heart, you are not getting it to your brain. You are not getting it to your body. It's just not going anywhere. Now, the mitral valve, which controls stuff from the left on the top going down to the left on the bottom, you know, Reggie said he had a heart murmur his whole life. It was probably that mitral valve. And so although it's something that does happen, because it was in a valve that is a little less common to see these sorts of repairs, maybe that's why he had to go to Georgia. Now, we have Da Vinci robots here in the islands, and we've had some surgeons come on and talk about it. Right now, I think they're primarily being used in the fields of gynecology and urology, but there's a lot of excellent applications for the Da Vinci robot. And, you know, I'm all about minimally invasive, and so I'm so happy, Reggie, that you wound up having that procedure done in such a way that you didn't have to have that major open heart surgery, although plenty of people do amazing after open heart surgery. And kudos to the doctors who determined that that's the way to do surgery, because that has really revolutionized the initial surgical approach for a lot of folks with heart disease. But minimally invasive surgery will hopefully allow Reggie to go back and be a circus artist with a brand new lease on life. And why not? I mean, I'm not really sure exactly what it takes to be a circus artist. I know I probably could never do it. But kudos to you, Reggie, and thanks for sharing your experience, because the most important part of your story, I think, is that you knew you had a little problem with a murmur, but as soon as you had symptoms, you went somewhere to go get it checked out. So that's excellent. Now, if anyone out there has had a similar story where they had a heart problem and or something amazing happened, or they took care of it and found something surprising to them, doesn't have to be as cool of a job as Reggie as a circus artist, but we'd certainly like to hear from you. You can join us at 941-3689, toll-free Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. Now, let's talk about some common stuff. I don't want to get heart disease, Dr. Rupike. I never want it. So if I'm a woman, as I am, and I'm afraid of heart disease, what age should I start worrying if my cholesterol is good, my blood pressure is good, my blood sugar is good? Okay, we won't talk about stress. But like, how young is too young? And can heart attacks happen in your 30s?
Heart attacks can happen.
Because I think I'm in my 30s, although I'm not. Add a few more years. I'm in denial. But let me live in my lying age of 36 for the rest of my life. Can I get heart disease in my 30s?
You can. And
how?
Well,
genetics.
It's partly genetics. This is one of the problems, is that you don't always get what you deserve, whether it be good or whether it be bad.
That's so true.
Because, and here's another thing that we may not like to admit, is that
we're older than 36.
Oh well, yeah, we won't talk about that.
Okay.
We don't know as much as we want to know, as much as we think we know about coronary artery disease. I mean, we've learned that heart attacks generally happen because a blood clot forms in an artery. And what happens, why does it form there? Well, usually because there's a cholesterol plaque underlying. So we think it has to do with cholesterol levels. So we know that if you smoke cigarettes, if your blood pressure is too high, if you have diabetes, if you're, you know, you're overweight, you know, all the usual things, if you have those, you are much more likely to have a heart attack, especially if you've had these things going on in your life for a while, which is why it happens when you're older. However, you can still have a heart attack when you're in your 30s, and oftentimes we don't know why. You might not have the traditional risk factors. We can do an angiogram, and we don't really see a lot of plaque everywhere. We haven't been able to get down to the level of actually looking at the lining of your arteries. They're working on some ways to image that, and that will be very interesting. But most of the people, most of the young people who do have heart attacks at a younger age, younger than 50 in men, younger than 60 in women, most of those people do have risk factors that have not been addressed. But some people, it is a great mystery, and it's just better for us to admit we don't always know, which is why it is important. If you have symptoms, even if you're not considered in a high-risk category, if you have symptoms, go check it out.
Sure, like Reggie did. He said, you know, I'm having this trouble. Doesn't feel good. I'm going to get it checked out. So at a minimum, if you want to know if you're at risk for heart disease, go check the cholesterol, the sugar, the blood pressure. Do that kind of basic stuff.
Right.
But if you don't have any of those risk factors and you're following a good diet and you're exercising and you're trying to keep an appropriate body weight, those things can all help you. No guarantees in life,
right?
But it'll certainly reduce your risk factors, right, from having something obvious.
Your risk is low, but it's not zero.
Okay. Now, that brings up another curious point, which is the recommendation on statins that was somehow modified because they said, you know, there's a lot of people with high cholesterol, but if they do this test, now, I've been a fan of it, although I've been a fan and then not a fan, and I've been very fickle about this test, and my fickleness is about the coronary artery calcium score. I love it, but I hate it. And I love it when the score is zero, because that means that there's no calcium that is calcified, and not necessarily that there's no blockages in the heart, but there's no really hard plaques. But I hate it when it's in the middle, because what do I do? And I really hate it when it's super high, because that's just scary. So I'm fickle about it. How do you feel about these coronary artery calcium scores?
Yeah,
lots of people have different thoughts.
I'm pretty mixed on that as well. You know, when you get a plaque in your artery, the longer it's there, the more calcified it becomes. So what they're measuring is calcium, which means you have plaque, but it doesn't say if it's obstructive plaque. Is it really interfering with blood flow or not? The most useful number on a coronary artery calcium score is zero.
So if you're zero, we love it.
That's right.
And if you're not zero,
oh, it's really hard to know. Then you need further testing. And if it's really, really high, it's very likely that you have heart disease. Now, I've seen a handful of patients who are referred to me because of a very high coronary calcium score.
Yeah, I've done that because I've been fickle. And then I've ordered the test, and one woman brought her husband to do it. And it was like 3,000. I'm like, oh, you're in serious trouble. And then you ordered a stress test, and he passed it with like flying colors. Right. And I'm like, well, so glad I ordered that test that told us nothing.
Well, one of the things that's been said also is it is still helpful because it helps you focus on your risk factors. You are in a high-risk group.
And you know what? When he saw you and he passed a stress test and you said you should take statins, mm-hmm. you should take cholesterol medicine, he took you seriously. He said, I'm going to follow the recommendation from Dr. Rapike.
Oh,
and I thought,
good.
Oh, thanks. Thank you so much.
Well, it identifies the high-risk patient. I think that's the one good thing about a coronary CT. You find in your patient practice like that high risk group, and they're aware that they're the high risk group. They start to have to take things seriously.
Well, and the other, you know, I look at it as, and I say, if your score is zero, things are really good. If it's anything other than zero, we'll talk. So I find that the test is most helpful, well, obviously, for the people for whom they get a zero, because sometimes it actually can lead them to not necessarily be on high-dose cholesterol medicine if they have a score of zero and their chances of developing cardiovascular disease are somewhat diminished, and the side effects of certain medications might make them scared and not want to take
right.
it. Never replaces exercise and watch your diet, but can be used adjunctively if you need to. All right. Well, I'm still fickle about it because, you know, I just am. But who knows? I mean, this may be another one of those tests that we're looking at in the future and maybe using it as part of an algorithm. The other concern that I had about it is there's radiation exposure.
Right. There is. And it's less radiation than a regular CT scan. They can kind of dial it down because they're not looking at a lot of detail. They're just looking at how much calcium is reflecting back at them, and they do a score on that.
But it's still some.
And here's the other thing is that I don't know a lot of data that says you have calcium score X. If you do this intervention, we expect your calcium score to go down to Y and your risk goes down.
And that's the other thing is that we don't necessarily have that prospective information. So, again, the test is so good when it's negative.
Yes.
And the score is zero. It's kind of like there's a couple of tests in medicine like that, like a SED rate. We love it when it's normal. And when it's high, it's like, I have no idea why. Why did I order it? You know, CRP can sometimes be like that. I've had people do this what's considered to be a highly sensitive CRP, which is a C-reactive protein, marker of inflammation, supposed to just be the heart. But boy, they get bronchitis. Their CRP is high because they have bronchitis and it says nothing about their heart. So it's one of those tests, you know, it's so good when it's negative and when it's positive. Mm. All right. We've got Jed on the line from Kahala. Jed, welcome to The Body Show.
Oh, hi. Hey, my question is kind of follow up. You know, I just heard you mention CRP and that's one of the aspects that I was curious about. But the various tests, you know, that can screen for the buildup, I guess, of cholesterol in the arteries and, you know, indicators of potential coronary heart disease, all related to diet. What, in your experience, what are you seeing these detrimental factors resulting from? More from a diet of saturated fats and cholesterol, or more of a diet associated with high glycemic index carbohydrates?
Good question. You know, I mean, really, it's do we see more of the problem with heart disease in those who have high cholesterol or those who kind of have foods that sort of just make me say diabetes, not that the person's diabetic, but the high glycemic index foods. Really interesting question. Now, you know, Dr. Liu, you see people, you put in stents, you do angioplasties, you do the interventions. When you look retrospectively at the risk factors of some of the people that you see, are there any dietary generalizations that you can make? Are there people who say, I never eat cholesterol, I don't know how this happened, but I eat a lot of these, what we would consider high glycemic, quickly absorbed foods with carbohydrates? Or generally, when you see somebody who has blockages requiring procedures, do they tend to have foods that are high in cholesterol on a regular basis? What do you see?
So coronary artery disease and what causes it, it's always kind of a difficult question because there are so many factors. That's what we call multifactorial. So you bring up the glycemic index, and the first thing I'd like to start off with is just to say that if you have diabetes, you are in a completely different risk factor.
Higher risk factor.
Absolutely. Okay. For coronary artery disease than someone who doesn't have diabetes. Diabetes predisposes you to premature coronary artery disease as well as a heart attack later on. It's the nature of the disease process in and of itself. If you take people who don't have diabetes then and they have questions about their diet and heart disease, what I usually always tell them is if you're talking specifically about plaque, what I like to say is the only way you can really take cholesterol into your body is if you have animal products. If you were to eat celery or grains or anything that didn't have animal products in there, you couldn't really, from your diet alone, increase your cholesterol in your body. That's why there's been such a movement in vegan diets. I know that's extreme. I know better than to tell my patients to go on vegan diets.
Yeah, because they're not going to be your patients for long. That's all I'm going to say.
Because I can't do a vegan diet. But, you know, if you kind of just want to stay healthy, you kind of want to be more conscious about what you eat and you kind of want to help prevent coronary artery disease, I would just say, you know, keep a healthy weight. And if you're a diabetic, keep your blood sugars in check. And if there are things that you would slow dietary changes that you would like to make, I would recommend decreasing the animal products that you take in your diet. And I think that's going to be a good general rule of thumb. You know, cheese, dairy, red meat especially. If you can just decrease the frequency of animal products, I think you're doing yourself a favor in the long term.
And so if we decrease the animal products, that may reduce the cholesterol. And if we add some other things in there that may have more of the carbohydrate basis, but they're not animal products, that would be a better way. As long as you're not diabetic, in which case, really be careful with that glycemic index of the foods, because that sudden rush of sugar into your bloodstream leads to a sudden rush of insulin, which can also lead to other problems. So I would choose, if I were you, Jed, I would say, go with the high glycemic index if you're not diabetic. And if you are, or if you're worried about that, then I would say don't eat the high fat diet or the high glycemic index. And don't ask me what you can eat, because that's probably going to be very limited. Yes, that is pretty much all of it.
Well, I think the data is changing.
You know, I realize that the dietary recommendations are probably pretty widespread. But just my own experience, about a year ago, I changed my diet to include a lot more, I guess, meats and fish and vegetables, you know, compared to carbohydrates, you know, like grains, breads, pastas, that kind of starch thing. My cholesterol went up, but the ratios all improved, as did my CRP. So it was a curious observation on my part to see that happen when I kind of expected, you know, the markers to get worse.
Well, sorry to interrupt, but it sounds like your diet probably is a little bit more balanced than it was before. And I think it's a lot easier if we can identify a culprit, a bad guy. You know, it's fat, it's meat, or it's sugar. I think it has to be really more of a balance. And I think the idea of the plant-based diet, the data is pointing more and more toward it's not just fat. It probably is sugars and too much sugars. I mean, we really aren't, I don't think, meant to eat that much pasta, that much bread. You know, grain is different now than it was 100 years ago. I think we need to get back to eating plants and not so much processed food and not so many animals.
Agree. Yeah, thank you.
All right, Jed. Well, thanks, because that's a great question, because a lot of people have thoughts about what diet is the best for them, and it's really hard for folks to know. And, you know, it is kind of paradoxical. You added some more of the animal products and your numbers got better. Hopefully that was including some more exercise and some other activities. And you're right, Dr. Apike. I think it's multifactorial. We will never find one smoking gun for if you eat trans fats, therefore you will get heart disease. And if you don't eat trans fats, you can eat any other fat there is. We'll never really be able to say something like that. I think there's just so many different different nuances to what people eat and how their body processes it and their genetic way to produce cholesterol. Because, you know, it your body makes cholesterol, by the way. We use it. We use it for good things. We use it for cell processes and a variety of different aspects of being alive. So, you know, even if you don't eat cholesterol, your liver is making it. And that's part of where the genetics come into play. So it is a combination of more than one issue. All right. We're going to have a quick break. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Dr. Lorelei Rapike and Dr. Jane Liu, both cardiology experts at Straub Clinic and Hospital. And when we come back, we're going to talk some more about where do we see the field of cardiology going in the future. And we'll talk about where you can learn more this weekend if you want to go to a free educational event. You can join us at any time at 941-3689. Toll-free Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. We'll be right back.
New Orleans is 4,204 miles from Honolulu as the crow flies, but the Fat Tuesday downtown celebration should bring it a little closer, at least for a while. The Arts District will become a collection of music, food, and performance art that offers a Pacific version of a centuries-old tradition. We'll get a preview tomorrow morning at 8 on The Conversation.
At the tops of their voices, in the manner of old lefties, what all in the manner we've always had. Damn the decibels, full speed ahead.
This week on Selected Shorts, George Saunders and John Sayles from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tuesday at 5 p.m. following Travel with Rick Steves.
Support for The Body Show comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting and Sacred Hearts Academy.
Welcome back to The Body Show. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Dr. Lorelei Rapike and Dr. Jane Liu, both interventional cardiologists at Straub Clinic and Hospital, gurus that I go to when I have patients and I have questions about cardiovascular disease. And the reason why we talk about heart disease is because it is one of the number one killer of people in the United States. It's cardiovascular. It's what we call atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, which pretty much means heart attacks and strokes. And how do we prevent those? And how important is it to really work on it when you're young so that you minimize your risk when you're older? Because we all kind of have this sense of invincibility every once in a while and do some stuff we probably shouldn't. And then we wonder how much is this going to have an impact later? We've talked a little bit about congenital heart disease. We've talked a little bit about cholesterol, why it's important to have it checked and to manage that if you can. We talked last week about the Ornish diet. We just talked a little bit about different dietary influences. Let's talk briefly about the changes in the world of stents. Dr. Rapike, when you first started practicing cardiology, people were doing balloon angioplasty and maybe bare metal stents. And now, Dr. Liu, you're practicing cardiology. We've got drug-eluting stents and all different varieties. Tell me about the evolution of stents. Lorelei, we'll start with you.
Yeah. First point is, I'm now the old person. But that's okay. I remember being the youngest doctor on staff, and that's not true anymore. And that's just okay.
You can be my lying age of 36.
Oh, there you go.
When my younger brother is older than my age that I lied about, people figure it out.
Interventions, they're quite exciting. So I've heard some stories about, when people were first able to do angiograms and see these blockages, and then there was nothing really they could do about it, and then the different ways they tried to clear the arteries of plaque started with balloons, and balloons seemed fine, but then they would re-narrow, you would get what they call restenosis just from scar tissue, so they came up with different scraping tools to try and get rid of it.
Roto-rooter, I remember that,
the coronary atherectomy, directional or rotational.
Someone
came up with the idea of putting in a stent, which is basically like, right now it's like a scaffold. They've had different designs that were more like coils that didn't work out too well. But, you know, different things to try and I tell the patient to hold the artery open. Well, it doesn't really hold it open. What it does is it provides a little bit of protection so you can do more complete angioplasty. You can use a little bit higher pressures without as much risk to the artery itself. And then the stent stays in and hopefully prevents the re-narrowing. And bare metal stents did reduce narrowing by, you know, instead of 50% narrowing, it reduced it down to, you know, 20% narrowing, but that's still 20%. So they started, they used different materials, different kinds of metal, and the latest thing now is different kinds of drugs that elute over time to prevent that or slow down the healing process, actually, which prevents the scar tissue from coming on very quickly. And then there was a question of, well, when that happens, the drug goes away, but you still have metal in your artery. What about the stuff they use to put the drug on there? You know, are there ways that we can make that stuff dissolve, maybe make the metal itself dissolve? So
things that we're looking at. So, yeah. So Dr. Lu, you're, you know, the other day we were going to have lunch in the cafeteria and it was, we actually bought the lunch. It was like tofu and quinoa. It was like super healthy and you didn't even have a chance to eat it because you had just been doing a procedure for a woman who was, you know, high risk and she was in her 80s, probably wouldn't have tolerated a big surgery but might tolerate this stent in her artery. So when you do things like that, do you always use stents that are what we call drug eluting, or they have medicine in the stent to protect the artery? And if so, how long does that last? How good are they? Are they pretty darn good for life?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. So the thing with these drug-coated stents is what's really exciting is when I started training, the thought was we would only put in the drug-coated stents for people who were not bleeding risks, because for everyone who's listening, if you get the best stent, which is a stent that's covered in a drug coating, it stays open longer, you will need to be on two blood thinners, usually aspirin and Plavix, every single day for at least 1 year, or else the stents close up. And it's very dangerous if the stents close up, and it's very dangerous if you don't take your medications for a year. So we would always put in the second best stents, or the stents without the drug coating, in patients who were at bleeding risks or were on another blood thinner, for example. What we found in Europe right now is people are starting to come off these blood thinners a little sooner than 1 year. And generally speaking, it's been pretty safe with the new drug-coated stents. The FDA here still mandates two blood thinners for 1 year. So I'm not recommending by any means coming off of the blood thinners sooner. But generally speaking, the way I practice is everyone gets the best stent, which is the drug-coated stent, unless they have surgery in a month or there's a back surgery that they need to get to. Because I do know that they're generally safe. The new and exciting thing about stents, and there are research trials already, are stents that are, quote, bioabsorbable. So right now, I take the best stent I've got and I put it in your heart. You have a drug coating that, generally speaking, will kind of absorb into your lining of your artery after about a year. But it's still a metal stent. And so if we put you on an X-ray, we still see the metal stent. What's really new and exciting is trials that have shown that a new bioabsorbable stent works just as well as the metal stents. Of course, this is brand new technology, but for the you know, people out there who say, well, I don't want anything in my heart, these new bioabsorbable stents stay open, keep your artery open, and then they kind of just...
It's like absorbable sutures. They just go ahead and they absorb. Right. And it sounds like that's a good, exciting way that we might see cardiology change in the future. We've got a caller in line. We have time for a quick question from Lori from Kailua. Lori, welcome to The Body Show.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for taking my call. I sort of have an unusual question. I had an adrenal tumor about 15 years ago, and with total metanephrines at like 5 times normal. And, you know, I had it resected, and I haven't had any cardiac workup since, and it all came out normal at the time. I was in my 40s. Would I need to continue something like that? Can I even ask that question?
Continue what exactly?
Well, other than the regular once a year deal that I have to do, should I be seen by a cardiologist? I mean,
oh, I see your question.
Damage at the time, but I have concerns because I'm still having lots of palpitations and forceful like stuff that just really doesn't feel comfortable. And
so I'm going to give you a very simple resounding yes. So here's the thing. If you have symptoms, and we heard earlier from our circus artist, Reggie, if you have symptoms of palpitations or you have symptoms of problems with chest discomfort, sure. You know, you had this adrenal tumor, and those things produce hormones that could make your heart go faster, make it flutter, make you feel bad. But as you get older, you could also just have problems with fibrillation, which we're going to talk about next week on the show. You could have problems with some other situation going on in your heart. So that if we assume that it's this old thing that you had a while back, we could assume, and you may know the little joke about how you spell the word assume. And if you don't know the joke, I'll tell you off air.
I do.
Okay. So, you know, as time goes on, it's always good to get your heart checked out. You may not necessarily need to see a cardiologist. You could see your regular doctor, have them run some basic heart tests, check cholesterol, check blood pressure, do an EKG, do some other testing like a Holter monitor if needed. But I would never ignore a symptom that could be your heart, because the heart, because of the chances that you could have a problem, and heart disease is extremely common and often missed in women, I would always err on the side of check it out with your doctor. It doesn't necessarily have to be a specialist, but get it checked out, because you'll never regret being proactive. Does that make sense?
Okay. Absolutely. All right. Thank you. That's what I wanted to know. Thanks.
Absolutely. Well, I hope you get it checked out and everything's totally fine. Now, I want to mention, because we've had some callers and they've wanted to know some things about the heart, and there's a wonderful opportunity for folks this Saturday, February 13th. It is free. I love that cost. Free. Starting at 8 o'clock, going till noon. Dr. Apike, you're co-chairing. Dr. Liu, you're also speaking there. It's a free conference called Valentine in Paradise, and the whole goal is to shed some light on serious problems with heart disease. And there are some folks you may want to contact if you're interested in going. Dr. Apike, if somebody says, I got to hear more about the heart, I want to learn about heart disease, because there's lots of things going on. They're going to talk about blood vessels and vascular issues, strokes, headaches, heart problems, kid heart problems like congenital heart disease. Who should they call?
Well, I'm trying to find the number here. Because all I see is register online.
Well, you can. And if you're going to register online, what should you do?
It's the website is HawaiiPacificHealth.org.
And so if you do web register online, that's absolutely perfect.
But
if,
I think you should be calling now, because we have, what I heard is 900 registrants for Ala Moana Hotel. And
that's
we usually have a big ballroom and we have a secondary room, but we pay attention to those people too. So they do want you to register. I don't think they'll turn you away if you show up, but they would like you to register. There must be a number there somewhere.
There is. You know, there is a number, 522-3469 is one of the numbers that you can call if you have concerns or you want to go to this conference. And then I always have people call our friends, the operator, because they can connect you to just about anywhere. And that's 522-4000. Those guys are excellent. And shout out to the operators, because they can connect you to the registration line for Valentine in Paradise. It's going to be a great event. You've put it on many years in a row. It's always been a huge success, like 900 people.
Yes.
How amazing to think all these people are going to want to learn about heart disease on a Saturday morning.
I'm actually amazed at how many people do show up on a beautiful Saturday morning, generally to spend 4 hours talking about heart disease or heart health. But we, you know, as a chair, I have to say that we do try and bring things that are current and hopefully not just something you've heard before. We certainly want to drive it home that heart disease is the number one cause of death in this country, and that there are interventions you as a person can make to improve your heart health. But, you know, we're talking... the subtitle is Head to Toe, which is not the most exciting subtitle. But because we're talking about cerebrovascular disease or stroke in your head, going down to the arteries down in your legs, peripheral vascular disease, we're trying to cover the whole system and talk about some new technologies and procedures and medications. And hopefully you'll come out and find it interesting.
get educated. We're always constantly in a world of getting smarter about things that we don't know about. You've done that. Dr. Liu, you've educated me about a whole bunch of stuff. I want to thank both of you for sharing your expertise with us today on The Body Show. If you'd like to hear the show again, you can click on hawaiipublicradio.org. Follow the links to The Body Show. You can also find us on Facebook. Our engineer is David Chong. Our executive producer, Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. We'll see you next week. We're going to continue our cardiovascular series. We'll see you right here at 5. Thanks for joining us on The Body Show.